Hey everybody, this is Dominique. Are you ready to do more with your life and money? I want you to stay tuned. Today we continue the series of the myths around financial advisors and financial advice. I am unpacking and dispelling several myths that I've uncovered and ran across in my conversations of nearly two decades in the financial services industry. You don't want to miss this. We'll see you in a little bit.
Are you tired of feeling like there's more to life that you're just not experiencing? Are you unmotivated by keeping up with the status quo? Are you ready to start living intentionally with your finances and creating the life you want? Get ready for Experiencing Financial Contentment with Dominique Henderson, a podcast focused on helping you create margin for the life you want to live by putting your money where your heart is. Each week, Dominique will help you explore the decisions you make around money so that you can achieve better results. Now here's your host, Dominique Henderson.
All right, we are back. My name is Dominique Henderson, owner and founder of DJH Capital Management, where we are helping our clients achieve their ideal financial outcome, and host of Experiencing Financial Contentment, the podcast where we, I would say, educate on everything financial literacy, economic empowerment, and personal development. So this is a well-rounded podcast. We're trying to cover a lot of topics, hopefully just to help you do more with your life and money. I mean, I always tell my prospective clients, my job as a financial advisor to you is to increase your quality of life and or increase your net worth. Not in any particular order, but if I can execute on both of those, usually we are happy. So happy usually indicates that you probably have to have a little bit of social indifference and take that pill to leave the matrix of the average so that you can have a life worth living that is meaningful and allows you to have meaningful relationships and do a lot of great things. So that's what we're all about here. And what we've been doing is dispelling some myths, right? We always like myths, right? We like unicorns and Bigfoot and all those things like that. Those are really salacious things that get our attention. But what I talked about last episode is there's a reason, once we get serious here, that your mind or your logic holds on to a particular myth, right? Like, you know, usually that's, you know, if your mind was being illustrated when it comes to a myth that you hold on to, or any type of just heuristic, let's just use a broader term, heuristic, a way of thinking, whether it's mythical or not, you have like a kung fu like grip on that thing. Like that's that's probably how it looks in your mind. And really, you know, if we're just kind of think about through ways to think about things, whether you're using deduction or your inferences or different things like that, there are some things in regards to financial advisors and financial advice, which I have just heard over the years that just are not true. So that's what we're spending time unpacking over these episodes. So we'll probably do one more. Today we'll continue around the general perception myths, general public perception myths. And as I noted before, if you don't have a copy, hit me up on Facebook. You should be on Facebook. There's 6 billion people on Facebook. So not 6 billion. Is it 6 billion? I don't know. It's a large number. It's in the billions. Anyways, the point is, if you're not on Facebook, you should be. Just get an account and hit me up. Go to Dominique Henderson, CFP. That's my public figure page, my business page. And you can send me a message. And if you type in 20 myths, 20 myths, M-Y-T-H-S, I will send you what we're talking about. And you can follow along. And it'll be easier that way. So let's get into myth 6 and 7. I'm going to combine myth 6 and 7. And again, we started this last week. So go back and listen to episode should be episode 37, just so you can get caught up if you need to. But so myth 6 and 7, let me read the myth and then I'm going to walk you through the logic, just how we did last week. So we're going to state the myth and we're going to just deconstruct the whole myth based on logic, right? And facts. And then you can come to a conclusion about whether or not you want to hold on to this myth after I present my argument. So that's kind of how things work, right? We're adults here. We just logicize through things, right? So Myth six says financial advisors should always outperform the market. And I alluded to in the last episode that I was going to go through this. This is going to be juicy. You want to stay tuned. Myth seven, financial advisors can outperform the market. So I think the way that I'm going to do this, I'm going to go like super high level, and then I'm going to dive really deep on you. And we're going to spend some time on this. Just because I think it's worth spending time on. So if you don't want to talk about markets, what you can do is just, you know, kind of like skip through this. But most people do want to talk about investments and markets. That's primary reason people talk about or talk with financial advisors. So I'm going to refer to my notes a little bit because I wrote some stuff that I think is pretty relevant to what we're talking about now. So I think you have to first start thinking about what is the purpose for investing capital, right? So when you're looking for a return, which is the reason why you invest into a market, excuse me, whether that be real estate or stock, equity, bond, whatever market you're investing in, you are looking to invest capital for a particular reason, and that's return. Now, total return, as I've written about before and talked about before, can be looked at in three different ways. If you're just breaking down the components of total return from a very academic standpoint, it's the growth of capital, right? So the capital appreciation, you buy at 10, it goes up to 20, or it goes down to zero, whatever. That's the amount of the change, right? The delta, the change between, you know, how you were in school and you did the percentage. It was the new minus the old over the old. That's what that is. So that whole component, that first component, we'll call the growth, whether it's negative or positive, right? And then you add to that the income, right? So rental property gives you passive income after you make the initial investment. You may get rents after all expenses of $100 a month or $1,000 a month. That is the income. It's just like a stock that pays you a quarterly dividend or a bond that pays you a semi-annual coupon payment. This is all income, and should be included in the function of figuring out what the total return is. And then last but not least is this component called compound interest, sometimes referred to as a wonder of the world, the seventh wonder of the world, or the eighth wonder of the world. I can't remember right now. But the point is the interest or the gain that your investment makes. So the interest made on the income. So think about that rent. Let's think about it this way. I've given this example before. So let's say that you buy a stock at 10. And it pays you a dollar dividend. That is a 10% dividend yield. That is the income represented by holding that stock when you purchase it at a price of 10 and get a dividend of 1. So that's 10%. Now, if that stock goes up to 20 and you still get a $1 dividend, well, then your yield is 5%. So the point being is, that income, every time that dollar comes in, it can purchase you, theoretically, another portion of stock, whether it's priced at 10 or 20. And then those shares that you purchase with that dividend will earn dividend. It's interest on your interest. So that's compound interest. So those three components are the components of total return. And that is the reason that you invest, is because you would like to see whatever you invest, let's call it $1, grow to something beyond $1, at least to keep up with the erosion of your purchasing power through inflation. So that is kind of, you know, reason to invest 101. Now, obviously, there are some components in which, or let's say there's some scenarios in which, excuse me, you would really not care as much for return as you would care for just the preservation of your capital. And those are really in what I would call market outlier type situations, like a recession or depression. Generally speaking, when people put money in a market, they're not looking to just preserve their capital. They're looking to grow their capital. So let's leave that aside. Although I fully acknowledge that capital preservation can be a goal for somebody, like, you know, in different instances. But for now, let's just kind of work with the fact that, you know, most of us want our dollar to grow to something else, and we're just not trying to leave it to be a dollar. Okay. So that was said, that was standing. If those are if the primary reason for investing is to grow your capital, what difference does it make if you compare it to what a market is doing, like the S&P or any other random benchmark? What does that really matter, right? So let's just say my goal when I come to somebody is to grow my dollar from 1 to 100 over 20 years, right? What does it matter if you're comparing the growth of my dollar to how good the S&P did 70 years ago or yesterday or tomorrow or whatever? Because when I come to you, it's clear that what I want at the end of the time period is $100. I can care less what the S&P did or the Dow. It's just irrelevant. Like, so let me pose this for a second before you have too much cognitive dissonance on the path that I'm going down right now. Those market indices are arbitrary, and I'm gonna tell you why. Let's pose this. Unfortunately, there's really no way of knowing whether or not this is true. You just have to kind of line up all the facts. And let me pose this. Could it be that a multi-trillion dollar machine such as the financial markets is being manipulated and used by multi-billion dollar firms to exploit this human need for being better than your neighbor? Like, that is a real human need. Like, we often measure ourselves by people next to us that are in our spheres to see if we're doing better than them for a lot of reasons. You know, we have our own insecurities and, you know, some legitimate ones, but mostly our own insecurities, right? So I'm sorry this is delving a lot into personal development today, but that's what the podcast covers. But if that's true, could it be that comparing your portfolio or your portfolio outcomes, rather, to something like the S&P is just a lure that will attract you to a certain set of products offered by those multi-billion dollar firms that are manipulating this multi-trillion dollar market? That is very plausible. And I'm going to tell you why I say that. I'm a student of the markets. I've been a participant in financial industry for nearly 2 decades. Longer than that, if you kind of span the fact that I started this all back in 1994 in my undergrad. So I've observed the marketing machine, and you don't have to look too far beyond financial industry, financial services, that is, to see this happening in other industries. It makes a lot of sense, actually. So if the whole game is steering you in a direction to purchase a particular product or service for, you know, the gain of some company, if you strip that away, then you're going to have to just be faced with the fact that I really just need to set realistic goals with a person that I can trust so that I can live the life that I want and not even really care about what the market's doing. Now, the market, granted, let's not confuse things. The market is a great proxy for how well you should be tracking the goal that you have. For instance, if you came to me and you said, Dominique, I realize that, you know, equity returns have been somewhere between 8% and 10% before taxes since 1927, since they start measuring the S&P. And I go, you're true. That's right. That is correct. And you're like, you know, so if that's the case and you've kind of factored in inflation, and this is just you and I having a logical argument because these things are all true, which has been 3% for some time. You know, really what I really need, Dominic, is somewhere between a 5 to 6% return so that I'll have enough for everything I want to do now, everything I want to do in the future after I finish working, and leaving some money to my heirs for an inheritance. I think that's reasonable, Dominique, for you to target somewhere between 5% and 6% real return for me over time. That is a very logical argument. And based in that, I would use the S&P or an equity market index as a proxy for, you know, affirming what you're saying and you probably eventually hiring me. So I say all that to say there's nothing wrong with using the market as a proxy, but to use it as a measuring stick to be competitive against and to measure your advisor against or to see whether an advisor is good, if they can beat the market, I think all these things are really irrelevant measures in the large scheme of things, and that you should be more focused on finding a goal that suits your plan, or finding a person that can fulfill your goals, realistic ones, in the plan that you're formulating that will get you to the life that you want. That's probably a better way to say that. So hopefully I wasn't rabbit trailing too much, but I did want you to just kind of explore that argument about this multi-trillion dollar market being manipulated by this marketing machine. It's a real thing. So we can talk about that later offline. It's a very juicy subject, and I love to have very, very vigorous debate. I love it. So let's go through myth 10, and we'll wind up all the general perception myths. And then next week, we'll talk about educational myths and training myths. Okay, so financial advisors only work with the wealthy. And I'm actually really happy to unpack some of the knowledge I have on this particular myth. This is definitely not true. I think historically our industry has catered to the wealthy and the ultra wealthy. And I'm going to tell you the reason for that, just so you can fully understand the scope of how things have turned about. So the typical financial advice business model is 1% for assets under management, which means that when you deposit $1 million with a financial advisor, typically they're going to charge you $10,000 a year to manage that money. And there's a lot of different ways to slice the pie on that, but that's just kind of the paradigm that has been around since really the late 70s, early 80s on fee for service on financial advice. And so when you start to think of from a business model standpoint, the financial advisor has to obviously cater his services or market to that crowd in order to be profitable. People that are what we would call the mass affluent that didn't have $1 million, they tend to shy away from those people because there was no model in place to serve those clients profitably. But in the last, I would call it 15 years, maybe a little bit longer than that, maybe last 20 years, there's been a paradigm shift in a lot of advisors, at least my age, let's call it the 45 and under crowd, that has started to see that the mass affluent needs financial services just as much as the wealthy, but they don't have the funds to deposit in order for us to charge the AUM. So what you've seen is a lot more creative economic business models come in that are, you know, based on, you know, maybe like retainers or financial planning fees that are billed monthly or different ways to skin the cat, if you will, so that financial advisors can be profitable, but still serve people that are of the mass affluent nature, which would be, you know, investable assets under $1 million. So no, financial advisors don't only work with the wealthy. There are a whole slew of advisors. And, you know, what's kind of cool is I actually coach advisors coming into the business on their marketing strategy and, you know, just their business model and things to kind of consider as they're tackling this beast that is, you know, a financial advice service model. So all that said, I know from having conversations firsthand with people that they do charge differently than that prehistoric model that I named before first, with which was just AUM. Now, what I'll say is that at the end of the day, you still have to be really diligent in finding the person that you want to transfer trust to, right? Any financial advisor that is, you know, kind of well aware and self-aware of what's going on here, we realize that we're trust agents. That's our function. The function is when you come to us with a plan that you want to execute without the time, expertise, or, you know, to do it yourself, essentially there's a level of trust that has to be transferred. Not all of it is immediate. Some of it happens over time, but there's a large level that is exchanged right up front. And we take that function, at least I take that function very, very, very dearly, which is the reason why, I've chosen to, you know, be conflict interest, free of conflicts of interest by the way I charge and how I render my service. So a lot of us take that very seriously, and we realize that. So We are not myopically focused on just a demographic of people that could put money in our pocket. Like we are very aware of, yes, there are bills to be paid and there are a living to be made. But at the same time, somebody's coming to us with their life savings in some instances. And there's a lot of trust that's being transferred. And in no way do we want to manipulate that or, move people in a way that is not ethical or moral. So all that to say, that's myth 10 dispelled. Hopefully I've dispelled myth 10. And that winds up part two of this. So again, if you want access to this, Facebook page is the best way to get me. Dominic Henderson, CFP, type in 20 myths, send me a message, type in 20 myths. I'll get you a copy right over. And if you want to continue this discussion, you can do it in the Facebook group or send me an email at feedback@djhendersonsr.com. The Facebook group is Creating Your Roadmap to Financial Contentment, where it's an addendum to the podcast. We get to carry on subjects and discussions like this a little further, more than the time would allow for in one particular sitting of the podcast. So I thank you for listening. I thank you for watching, and we'll see you later. Take care. Bye-bye.